Let me first begin by thanking everyone who's made this visit possible, especially Michael and his staff at the NFSA, including especially Krista Pocknell and all my old and new friends here for your kindness and hospitality. It's a great privilege to speak at the start of this symposium. I was last at FIAF in Los Angeles in 1995, and I remember projecting tiny QuickTime images off a CD-ROM onto a giant screen. I think this may have been the first time that 320 by 240 pixel images were presented at one of your congresses. And so despite this rather depraved rejection of resolution and quality, you are most welcoming. And my provocations today will therefore be purely verbal. Let me specify for a moment the position from which I believe I'm speaking. Do I identify as an archivist? I'm not quite sure. I'm not an institutional archivist, certainly. These days, primarily collect home movies and try to propagate archival materials to the world as best I can. I touch film as often as I'm able, but I've not been socialized or formally trained as an archivist. I spend most of my time, in fact, thinking about the history and the future of archives. And I tend to think maybe the term meta-archivist might be the most descriptive. Starting in late 2000, I was fortunate enough to join with Internet Archive to build a freely downloadable online collection. And the opportunity to provide a fairly high degree of access to materials that I'd collected was life-changing. This project turned me into a collaborator, a virtual collaborator, with many hundreds of thousands of people around the world. I can't know how many. And it also helped enable the production of thousands upon thousands of derivative works from this material. Again, we can't know how many. The films propagate, work gets made, access events happen. Being able to give away pictures, sounds, and data at scale is a tremendously privileged position, and it's caused me to think somewhat differently about archives and access to the cultural heritage than many others might, so that I don't take archival workflow, as I understand it, for granted. And I'm not even sure that I take archives, as I know them, for granted. And so I'm a little unsure whether I have the right to use the term we when I speak of archivists, but I'm going to do it anyway, because it's more efficient. So like most of us, I'm greatly fascinated with the material with which I work. That fascination is the expression of a particular flavor of cinephilia, because the power of the moving image is matched only by its inconvenience. The contradiction between our desire to preserve images and sounds forever and their increasing impermanence never gets easier to live with. And the only way really to understand this desire is to think of it as manifested in acts of faith. It's hard to touch these ideas. But what I'm going to try to do in today's talk is address some of the conditions that make us anxious, ask us to put aside some of our received ideas about the practice and theory of collecting images and sounds, and try to pose a few harder questions. I have little new to say about the great externalities. We're faced with the possible end of film. In this age of retro-tech, in this age of typewriters and vinyl, I'm hard-pressed to believe that it's permanent, but it's troublesome. And we're faced with a condition that is systemic, but I really hope might end, the marginalization of the theatrical experience of cinema. And we're faced with extremely aggressive and disruptive behavior from a cohort of mostly young but very powerful businesses that seek to digitalize the world's economies, cultures, and relationships. But this isn't the entire story. Archives are more resilient than many might think. If we question some of our unexamined beliefs and assumptions, if we experiment with new workflows, new forms of access, new economic models, we have a shot at living through the complicated years. And most important, I think we can live and work with less anxiety. The digital turn is no different than other disruptive waves of industrialization, and I must say austerity. Its promoters naturalize its power to overturn by invoking the old idea of creative destruction and proclaiming that there are no alternatives. Its sense of inexorability has its roots in countercultures, as the scholar Fred Turner found, as well as in finance and engineering, and it is promoted, the digital turn, is promoted day and night. But despite its apparent victory, digitality is fragile. It requires a compliant social order, the accommodation of governments, and the steady availability of energy. It is not a monolith. The Chinese digital world works differently than the North American, and its corporate structures and business models, and I can't emphasize this enough, its corporate structures and business models are experimental. We cannot overreact today to a force that we may behave differently tomorrow. I think of the relationship between archives and the threats that surround us as asymmetric, but not in the same way they once were. Even if we were smaller and weaker than large corporations, at first the studios, now the internet companies, we were centralized, complacent, defensive. We circled the wagons to protect our collections and our very existence. But you know, now the big dot-coms are becoming lumbering bureaucracies, and we have an opportunity to outthink them, to be more nimble. There are engineers who would prefer to work for us than for a Google. Some of us feel we've come late to this battle. This is not bad. In so doing, we've avoided making premature decisions and made time to observe the, enemy. Incrementalism, which might first have occurred to be a loser strategy, is in fact radically traditional. Many of the world's great libraries acted out of fear and perhaps a sense of inferiority when they signed secret agreements with Google to digitize their collections. I shouldn't say digitize, I should say to take pictures of their books. This has not changed the world. This has not changed the world in the way we thought it would. Even though the libraries gave Google the books, for the moment, we are in a phase where books see less use than a generation ago. But this condition existed before Google began to scan. There was nothing of the library and Google's search and advertising model. There is still very little of film archives that surfaces in the embryonic online models that we've built or seen. We can still think freely about the terms with which we engage those who would take our collections online. And it's now clear that digitization is not a one-time project. Just as film-to-film copying has been done over and over again, as technology and skills improve and new materials turned up, the first scan can't be seen as an all-or-nothing proposition. Bits are not the enemy. They signify a different operational model of the world. Yes, a new culture is built from them, and amnesia often seems to prevail, but digital culture is also fragile. It's a new system of labor that only thinks it's free, and it's exhausting its consumers. Maintaining my new cell phone, my social media, my email, my computer, and fixing broken systems is at least a half-time job, unpaid. I get impatient when a European contact won't reply to my emails on the weekend, but I envy the higher value that you place on your time. In my work with our library and archives, I've come to realize that digital and physical are not opposites, but complementarities. Each has a different job to do, and each is waiting, and I think eagerly, to work with the other. The turn to digital, in fact, revalidates the analog. But it isn't quite the same as it was before. It's hybridized with digital. You know, I make digital films that play in front of audiences who talk while the film plays. Cinephiles hate them because it's a violation of the contract, the compact. I thought this was a radical move until I realized what I was doing was actually extremely traditional. It recalled the Elizabethan theater with the loud and boisterous groundlings in the front pit, letting the actors and the rest of the audience know what they thought about the show, hybridized, analog and digital. Books have a new cachet. I must disagree with the thought that print is dead. Book sales are rising again, at least in the States. And it's inconceivable to me that an increasingly thoughtful and educated audience will completely reject film exhibition once they've learned what the replacement lacks. Recorded sound did not kill performance. Industrial production and distribution models did not kill the need to gather in physical spaces and experience collective presence. I understand that digital collective presence is a different animal. But capitalism, which has adapted to foreground certain kinds of digital objects, can adapt back. Film and the theatrical experience are now suffering in the valley of neglect. There seems to be a period of indifference, a period of latency, late in the first life and before the rebirth of objects, when physical objects are widely seen as a liability. This, you know, is the period when barges full of nitrate, TV kinescopes, and recording masters were dumped off coastlines, the age of secretive transports from books away from libraries, the age when VHS tapes were thrown in boxes and put on the street for homeless people to resell. Although Yale University needs to be recognized for its recent acquisition of 2,700 horror features on VHS. But at some point, the artifact regains its cachet. And I believe, and I know you may disagree, that the theatrical experience is in eclipse, but it won't die. If we see archives as long-term propositions, not temporary structures, we can take time to ponder our rules of engagement with digitality. But there is no excuse for not engaging. Historians describe a practice that they call presentism. We are presentist when we apply current modes of thinking to the past and the future. Right now, it is tempting to eternalize the present and imagine a future based on disturbing trends that have not been with us for very long. It is short-term thinking, I believe, to regard the apparent end of film and the collapse of the photochemical manufacturing chain as a definitive threat to film culture. It is presentism to regard digitality as the negation of film culture, or for that matter, to think of digitality as the negation of analog culture. I believe that deeply held feelings of cinephilia drive us to read current history in apocalyptic terms. I was asked to provoke, and so I will. In our own ways, we are all cinephiles, but cinephilia may not be serving us well. Cinephilia is no defense against precarity or competition. Cinephilia does not convince budget controllers or uninterested citizens of the urgency of our work. We need to be more than cinephiles. We need to articulate reasons for our practice, not simply accept it on an unspoken level. We need to look outward beyond our walls and beyond our parent organizations. We need to advocate for our institutions and for the field itself. I believe this is widely understood. We need to understand that even if we work in a private institution or deep within a government department, we are effectively working for everyone and for those of us not yet born. To properly serve the records that we collect and preserve, we need to do more than love them. Films are powerful, but they lack the power to preserve the institutions that preserve them. Cinephilia quite naturally engenders the desire to love and protect. Excuse me. And we have become overprotective. There is too much force majeure in the archives world. We're tasked with enforcing rules that are not of our making. We have earned the right to greater autonomy from those who own or claim rights. And we've earned the right to make our collections available. Our work is hobbled by a precautionary mindset. We are still excessively deferential to non-existent claims from unidentified rights holders who may not even exist. Those that do exist may not respect the work that we do to protect their rights. Most archivists are socialized from the very beginning of their professional training to assume that archival materials are all someone else's property, intellectual property, which may not always be the case. I can certainly understand how we must often comply with obviously anachronistic laws, but I have a difficult time understanding why we so often stop short of questioning them. A word about this passage. An economics of scarcity must give way to one of abundance. the nation which discovers how to release to mankind the great storehouse of creative energy shall inherit the earth. That's a little bit creepy, but the idea is good. This was a study by a lawyer as part of a congressional investigation of concentration of the economy during the Great Depression. And this was a study on patents and the small inventor versus the large corporation. It's a wonderful document. It was almost immediately disowned after it was published, because although it was written by a very eminent and patrician lawyer, he was a little bit of a traitor, I think, to his class. How do we want to think about copyright as laws evolve? You know, I don't want to go into minutiae, but I'm concerned about two issues enough to call them out. One of them is extended collective licensing. This has been tremendously popular in European policy circles, and it's being discussed seriously in the United States. And questions also that transcend short-term copyright disputes. ECL is a real problem. And the regularization of orphan works concerns me as well. I've come to believe that in some ways the best solution to the orphan works problem is not to do very much, because sometimes the remedy may be worse than the disease. Melissa Terrace has been doing a great series of blog posts about the new UK regime for clearing orphan works. Well worth reading. Who will these collective licensing organizations be? How much will they cost to administer? And who will get the money? And why should an individual or a scholar go through the same process that a major publisher or studio must do to be able to work with an orphan work? Could we have built an internet archive under an ECL or a regularized orphan works regime? I doubt it. And then the long view. As cultural custodians, we're obliged to take the long view. And this means we cannot postpone thinking about issues that last longer than copyright and pose more profound questions. For instance, if we move towards openness, how do we temper openness with kindness and respect? Questions of Aboriginal, Indigenous, community, cultural, and intellectual property rights, questions of the moral rights of creators, these pose issues that go far beyond the bounds of copyright. These are issues that will outlive short-term discussions. When the so-called copyright wars appear quaint, these issues will still be part of shaping the kind of world that we hope to live in. And let me just say that I recognize it's a bit unfair for someone from the United States, where we have a rich public domain, even if its growth is stunted, to be critical of copyright regimes around the world. And I must also admit that the U.S. is one of the motivating forces behind these treaty-based IP initiatives like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is now being negotiated in secret. But wherever anachronistic copyright laws exist, we need to question the reason for their existence and work to change regulations if they no longer protect real interest. Archival privilege. The right to control the dissemination of materials, whether it's exercised by archival custodians or by copyright owners, relied on scarcity. But archives can no longer control the spread of their holdings. Archival privilege is also closely related to generational divides. The kind of work that's being made by younger makers is sometimes hard for archives to understand and support. This is a supply-side problem, and it kind of rhymes with the problem on the demand side, that the difficulty of getting material legitimately out of many archives has led many younger authors and media makers to regard archives as obstacles to use, rather than enablers to use, of course, a problem. We sometimes express anxiety about the loss of control when moving images propagate too freely, especially in digital form or without that watermark. But for me, by contrast, it's the enclosed archives. It's collections that are deprived of their potential to thrill, to educate, to change minds. That's what makes me anxious. To follow from that, isolation and defensiveness have led some of us to see our work not as a means to an end, but as an end in itself. Possibly poets and musicians and experimental artists might have more justification to think this way than we do. If the archives is to be a point of origin and the birthplace of new works, rather than, as Michael said, the place films go to die, we've got to rebuild the cycle of the life cycle of archival material around reuse. And as many of our colleagues are learning in textually based repositories, put the user at the center. We know that the demand for most of our collections is minuscule, but we can try to increase it through aggressive efforts to expand access. And you know, this term is questioned. And I have to express disagreement with the idea that access is a neoliberal term that principally applies consumption. I would prefer to think of access as the process, or perhaps more accurately, the continuum that enables the human right to participate in the making of culture and the making of history. If I oppose neoliberal attacks on public institutions, and if I oppose the attempt to put a price on everything, the last thing I would want to do would be to increase scarcity. I'm deeply fascinated by the discussions of film curatorship and the film museum idea, which, you know, correspond to the vital discussions on convergence that are now occurring in the museum, library, and archives world. But I want to figure out how can we build museums with permeable walls? Digital bits flow through walls much better than paintings, I'll just say that much. Here are some attributes of the accessible archives. I won't go through every one, but you know, every one of these has hope built into it. Number three, limits access to collections only as required by law, respect, custom, and unavoidable constraint. But unavoidable constraint is the key. Measures value by consumptive use. I wish in some ways our codes of ethics had said early on that we exist to be consumed. And I don't mean consumed in the market sense. Avoids being hobbled by the precautionary principle. We couldn't approach the edge of the dock last night. That was the precautionary principle in action. It's certainly clear that we cannot offer access to everything. And yet, as we explain the rationales for enclosure, and as we make our excuses as to why certain materials are not publicly available, we're responsible for specifying as clearly as we can why we can't release a record. How and when will it be released and by whom? If we cannot offer openness, let's at least plan for it. And I should emphasize that if we draft an openness plan that's public, we should specify which records we will also declare to be outside the realm of property. We have a lot of practical problems that we cannot easily dismiss, but we can alter the way that we think about them. In the film Curatorship Conversations, David Francis said, and I think wonderfully, "I'd love to find somebody to fund an experimental archive where we could try out ideas without having to worry about the financial implication, where we could try and put into practice the ideas we are talking about theoretically. I would just like to have the ability to change, represent, and rethink until we got things right." You know, librarians are doing this. People in the digital humanities are doing this. Perhaps some of them talk about doing it more than they actually do it, but many of them are doing it. If the archives are to adopt some of the trappings of the museum, it might also remember to build a laboratory. I do not suggest huge expensive projects, but modest experiments that address unresolved difficulties. And here are just a few thoughts. We bemoan the digital fire hose, the flood of undifferentiated production that's impossible to appraise, describe, contextualize, and collect, let alone preserve. But you know, as the digital moral panic escalates, I find myself much more interested in the backlogs of physical film that seem to defy efforts to process them. Could we bring non-professionals into the back of the archives to work with materials, annotate, repair, conserve, prepare for copying and scanning? Could we build what I call participatory physical archives? I ran a 2-year experiment in San Francisco that was supervised by Selznick-trained archivists, and we did minimal processing and scanning prep on 4,800 out of a 12,000-item home movie collection. It was not a total success, but we exchanged, people received paraprofessional training in exchange for film work that otherwise would never have happened. We let the public in the back of the archive, so to speak, not just in the gallery or in the research room. Could we bring the best makers into the archives to work with us and make new films from our collections? I know that a number of you have done this. But in the broader sense, could we imagine the archives as a place of production where films are made, games are coded, websites designed, books written, television produced and transmitted? Could we look to archivists to do some of the work themselves? There's a long-time idea, and I know it's reflected in codes of ethics in some sectors, that archivists and archives should not themselves engage in research or production. But I think we could try to let this long-time antinomy between the roles of archivist and producer rest. Could we operate creative laboratories that focus not only on making new works, but on remaking archival workflows themselves? Libraries and textual archives, and now AMIA, sponsor hackathons, sessions where people make new software tools. From the early printers at the National Film Archive to the shorter pitch sprockets machined for shrunken film to the many DIY scanner projects that we're seeing on YouTube to David Rice's apps to analyze digital video streams. The roots of archival workflow are in do-it-yourself culture as much, if not more, than cinema arts. DIY culture has always been baked into what we do. We lament that so little of our material is of interest to research and producers. Well, if that's true, if so much of our material is unused, why don't we consider paying people to use our collections? In fact, we already do this with commissions, with contests, with residencies. I'm not being facetious when I suggest that if our mission is to push historical and cultural materials out into a crowded and often indifferent present, to champion and to preserve the art of the cinema, then it might be appropriate to find the most adventurous ways of encouraging reuse of our material. In short, for me, quiet archives are much more anxiety-provoking than noisy ones. I suspect one way to become clearer about our course is to reinvest the archives with a sense of intentionality. Each moving image was created for a reason. And the intentionality of particular records coalesce into the totality of the archives. But the tradition of archival neutrality often keeps us from fixing on intentions, on missions, and outcomes. You know, this is at the base of this issue that has come up in historically in the discussion of the Latin American archives that focus much more on screening and access than on preservation. We need to do much more than simply preserve the cultural heritage for the future. What is happening in the present? And archivists themselves should be encouraged to play much more of an interpretive role. We could address the misunderstandings about archival work. We could push forward a bundle of new narratives that speak to the centrality of archives in the world. Because I believe that to engage in archival activity is to intervene in history's flow. Even a passive collection that simply responds to queries still plays an interventionist role. I think of Alex Horvath's proposal of, or description of, an archive that is also a critical museum, a confrontation, he says, of concrete artifacts and social practices, an actively and poetically constructed collection, a place in which curatorial thinking and work can be felt and argued with. It would stand counter to the ideology of the market. It sounds like a university to me in some ways, and I'm not sure that's a bad idea. Possible futures. A bit of an odd one, but reading my sci-fi, I learned about the permaculture principles, and I think that there's aspects of environmental thinking that can contribute some frameworks to archival thinking. If you look at some of these points around the clock, they really are elements of an archive's manifesto. You know, harvest while it's abundant, self-regulate, accept feedbacks, use and value renewables. What is, this is as archival as you get. Design from pattern to detail. You know, this is in a sense the les fonds in a lot of ways. use and value diversity, but most interesting, I think, use edges, value the marginal, that innovation, that evolution happens where different communities meet. At the edge of the shoreline, the organisms from the ocean meet the organisms from the land, and evolution takes place. And this is so much the principle that I think guides a lot of our work, even if we don't recognize it. This is what leads me to say that digital and analog are not oppositions. They're complementarities that will recombine in ways we haven't yet anticipated. You know, I'm also interested in the issue of archival accountability seen through the prism of environmentalism. In the United States, when we need to build something, we have to draft an environmental impact statement. In our field, what if we had a preservation impact statement, an access impact statement? I do want to say that the collection policy discussion, the drafting of collection policies in many ways is another way of doing the same thing. But I think that notion of accountability, of trying to project the impact of some of our decisions, would be a very, very good idea. Our conversations about archives suffer from an excess of practicality. While some of us engage in reflection, and I refer especially to some of the recent articles in Journal of Film Preservation, The Moving Image, and elsewhere, quite often these initiatives, these ideas, don't percolate through the field. Theorists who do not work in archives project all sorts of ideas onto what they call the archive. For them, archives are blank screens. They could even be sort of playthings. And scholars and producers regard archives as repositories for what they wish we collected, made available in the ways they want to use it. We spend a lot of time resisting the identities that are projected onto us. But only a few scholars ever speak directly with archivists. Few have spent even a day rewinding film or moving cans from one vault to another or digitizing videotape. Workflow is almost totally absent in academic discussions of the archive. And yet workflow is far more political. It's far more potent in its effects on archives than 100 conferences. Despite the gap between the archive and archives, between theory that takes little account of what archives really are and what they do, we need to harvest ideas that we can use. There's a rapidly growing corpus of thought about the archive, in quotes, that rarely takes account of actual archives. But some of it is valuable. Some of it is even urgent to engage with. It's not accidental that you're seeing a tweet, because the gray literature of the present, the gray literature of today, happens on Twitter. Not everybody writes books. Not everybody writes academic papers. Not even blog anymore. But there's the tweet stream about archives is constantly formative and filled with gems. It's worth watching. I hesitated a long time before mentioning this today. But I decided I have to. And to heighten the drama, I'll take a drink. I find an empty center in many of our discussions about archives. Since the very beginning of the film archives movement, I think there's been a steady retreat from explaining why we engage in collecting and preserving film, why archives exist and why they're important, and what our goals might be. It is certainly possible that one of the archivist's less celebrated skills has been the ability to hide, to maintain a safe environment for collections by staying under the radar. And of course, we've had to hide from rights owners who would repossess materials and bureaucrats who might not understand the importance of what we do. This is understandable. But we cannot continue to rely on oversimplified, inoffensive, celebratory statements that are geared for public consumption. The quiet that we often maintain facing out is matched by a quiet when we look inward. For the most part, moving image archives seem to exist in a kind of teleological vacuum. What is our purpose? We don't speak about it. It's good that we exist, but I've yet to see much thoughtful examination as to why. Our work is too complex and difficult to hide behind the missions that are assigned to us. Dépôt légal, heritage preservation, maintenance of the juridical administrative evidential record. but near religious reasons that we feel that cannot be shared with lay people do not rise to the level of justifying the special work that we do with fragile materials. And they do not give us the ammunition we need to defend ourselves against those who don't consider our work important enough to fund. To actively consider the reasons for our existence is also to ask, could we, as archivists, point ourselves toward an agenda that we wish to make real? The eminent technological historian David Nye suggests that an eclectic approach to history makes sense at this point. He said in November 2014 at the Society for the History of Technology in Dearborn, he said, no grand theory is adequate to our interdisciplinary enterprise. If we use concepts carefully, with an awareness of their provenance, we can give a theoretical dimension to the history of technology without confining it to a single system of thought. Many historians practice this principled eclecticism. This bricolage is not just defensible. It is more durable and provides more robust arguments than reliance on any single theory. We are interdisciplinary because our subject matter is too universal and too complicated to be understood from a single perspective. When I was young, the best holiday present a child could have was an electric train set. But today, electric trains are out. They've become specialized playthings for adults. Simple wooden train sets are back in vogue. I take this to mean that we cannot necessarily assume that the current fascination with tech tools and with digitality will last forever. And as Raymond Williams suggests, we live in a culture where the emergent and the residual coexist and interact. So as we plunge into the digital vortex, I would hope that we remember that core tenet of conservatorship, reversibility of process. Let us not deny change, but let us also remember that much of the future will lie in the unresolved past. And I thank you.
My name's Quentin Turner. I work at the National Archives of Australia. I have to confess I came into your speech with my hackles a bit raised because, regrettably, the previous speaker had referred to the Film Australia YouTube channel as potentially the National Cinematheque. Now, as someone who's been involved as an Australian trying to establish and maintain a National Cinematheque as a direct access to the historical experience of theatrical screenings, that was a disappointing experience, that thing to say, and I'll engage with that person later on about it, though. Anyway. But what I'm really impressed with, Rick, is I've heard you speak before, and I think your talk is a different one from what I've heard previously. You're engaging with debates around some of the ideas being quotably neoliberal. I think I'm really impressed by the way that you're engaging with some issues I haven't heard you previously. Do you think you've shifted your position a little bit on some of these issues in recent times? I've found your response to some of them, you're willing to talk about some of the issues that I know that people have come back to you and attacked your positions. I'm more in line with what you're saying now than I had previously, and I do detect some kind of shifting, particularly in your more encouraging relationship with the analogue and your feeling that there is a place for the analogue and that the digital and the analogue are more complementary.
Well, I have to confess that to prepare for this talk, I went back and read 25 years of the Journal of Film Preservation, or at least skimmed it. Quentin, a lot of this has to do when my spouse and I started a library in San Francisco, which is a room full of paper. We weren't nostalgic by any means. You know, we've scanned quite a lot of it at Internet Archive, but we discovered that people were relating to paper in ways that we hadn't imagined. And I realized that we needed to, that it was really important to think outside these stereotypical terms opposing analog and digital. Because, you know, these terms are quite often, I mean, there's the business side, where these terms have the power of disruptive economic, the power of capital behind them. Digitality has a lot of money behind it. But also it's journalists looking for a good story, looking for contradictions, looking for battles. And a friend of mine, a poet, Jen Bervin, said at one point, poems are funny things, but they have jobs to do. And I came to realize that analog and digital both do different things very well, and it's just not sensible to think about these, nor is it historical, to think about, you know, it's not a giant wipe where things get pushed off the stage. So there's that. And then also over time, you know, I'm a professor now, so I have to, I'm teaching, and I have to decide, do my convictions really make sense? Do I want to tell the students things that I haven't fully considered? So whatever, yeah. I would hope we'd all continually evolve over time.